Well, I'm sure we've had the same experience. We're walking down a street, we're getting on a plane, or we're looking right here at Holden Village, at who's reading what when they're sitting out in the sun. And this is, of course, volume one of the millennium. Pastor Nancy Linder, our village pastor, led a very spirited discussion of it yesterday morning at 7:15
eye opener.
And I have only finished the first of the three books by Stieg Larsson of Sweden, but and I'm certainly no literary critic, but I find it, I mean, quite apart from the plot, etc., I find it a very authentic description of contemporary Sweden. Had this been a class where there had been a reading list and blah blah blah, I would have most definitely urged you to, and that said, as one who has not yet plowed into volumes two and three, I understand that some entrepreneurial travel agency, I suppose, in Sweden is doing land office business, organizing millennium tours where people walk the streets of Stockholm, where Kalle Blomqvist and the Elisabeth Salander were. Well, just a little warm up. I love always to go back to the maps. Estimate that the Arctic Circle runs somewhere like this. Just stop and think how much of Norden is above the Arctic Circle. How much of Norden does not see the sun, much of the sun, in the winter months, or much darkness in the summer months. Nowhere is that more true in a way than if we take Denmark, which you say is further down. But Denmark owns probably the most unattractive piece of real estate in the world, Greenland, where the drain on the Danish treasury is simply immense in terms of public health and the needed technologies and the shipping lanes required to get commodities to the sparse population along the coast of Denmark, of Greenland. The realtor who promoted that development got it all wrong. For Iceland was a part of the Danish Empire also. Iceland ain't exactly green, but it's downright bucolic compared with Greenland, which is icy. So the North, the great Swedish author, one of the first recipients of the Nobel Prize in Literature, Selma Lagerlöf, had a line like this in which she talked about what it is to live in the far, far north. One of her lines was Svenska, was it? Och hur ska vi finna Bethlehem? How shall we ever find our way to Bethlehem? What was so far north? And with that, we wound up last time talking about the great late. I am using Sweden loosely yesterday as my case study nation in terms of immigration. When I said in the 1970s, the welcome mat was open to labor force immigrants, that is, people who were willing, capable of age to perform the infrastructure support jobs in the service industries, the restaurant industry, the hospitals and nursing homes, etc. And and in a way, what I had the opportunity to witness there, it leaves one breathless. I mean, we went through this. I won't repeat it, but what more can you do? Jobs, housing scattered across the country so that there would not be ghettos and barrios and language classes every day on the employer's dime, and children who were eased into the learning of Swedish, who were not left to have to go cold turkey from their native languages. I could have added one more, the belief of what I'll call the political science industry in Sweden, that the that one of the keys to successful assimilation is the politicization of people. And so Sweden extended the ballot to immigrants from the day they landed in local elections, not national elections, but all of these elements. Andy, you asked last time for a diagnosis of how it all worked, and I use the past tense. I would say two things. It all simply collapsed economically. The juggler had too many balls in the air, and as I tried to describe last time. And as the Swedish economy went a little bit sour in, say, the 1980s, the price of svenska kvalitet of products with the precision of the ball bearings, Ericsson in mobile phones, Saab, Volvo, Husqvarna in sewing machines, Kostaboda in glassware, etc., became such that the price of those commodities it became very difficult for them in the world market, and there was unemployment and a lack of tax revenue coming in. And the conservative, the bourgeois coalition reaped the fallout and came into power for a while, and more or less slid out of these support systems. Though one commitment remained and remains, and that is that the goal of immigration in Sweden is to make people Swedes, to assimilate them, to see that they learn the language fluently. It just a spectacularly interesting case study for a social scientist. Everything sort of went awry. It worked to scatter people across all of Sweden, so that they didn't congregate, as long as housing was scarce. But when housing in some of the Swedish cities got overbuilt, of course, the immigrant families there said, Uncle Boris can come and live in an adjoining flat. And Uncle Boris brought a wife and seven children four children-in-law and 11 grandchildren, and on and on and on. So that's an example of one of the things that undermined the system. But immigration continues into Sweden, as it does into Denmark and Norway. I think I said last time, Finland and Iceland really are not contending with a big immigration issue for all sorts of reasons. But now it is not labor force, it is political refugees for whom, in the humanitarian spirit of the Nordic countries, places must be found. And so And I offer this up to you when you are discussing the Nordic countries, which I trust from the moment that you get home you will engage forevermore in seminars on this topic. When people say, well, you know, it's easy for the Nordic countries to have these benefits because they're so homogeneous. You scratch any sizable market town now in Sweden and Denmark, and many a town in Norway, and I will predict that the number of languages spoken by children in the elementary schools will be in the 20s and the 30s. I will predict that the 30 to 40% now of the children of school age have at least one parent for whom a Scandinavian language is not the mother tongue. How's that for political incorrectness, mother tongue? It is that these nations have become hugely heterogeneous ethnically, but the complexities of the assimilation of the new refugee and exile immigrants, Albania, Kosovo, Bosnia, Montenegrins, an earlier wave from Chile and El Salvador, from the genocides of Rwanda and the displacements in Somalia, etc., are really quite daunting. I spent the winter of 2000 in Malmo in Sweden's third city population, and in the shopping mall areas, in the markets, had turned into intricate subsystems of little cafes and coffee houses and that sort of thing, where the men, and I use the term advisedly, could gather and sit all day as they had in their marketplaces in their own countries. The in-service training that is required now for teachers to be able to cope, the issues for the church, nation which has become so very Muslim in so very short a time are self-explanatory. Now, just as I use Norway as a case study about the political party structure, I've used Sweden for immigration, but I'll just take a sideways glance and say, it is much the same in Norway, except the immigrant stream is largely from Pakistan. And therefore combines, of course, Islam with a high degree of entrepreneurship, which in a nation which has been organized by trade unions and collective bargaining, agreements, etc., is baffling, of course, for the trade unions. These entrepreneurial operations, of course, are quite oblivious to the the labor contract theories. In Denmark, a part of the continent, the flow of political and maybe more so economic exiles from the Middle East and again I think from what the nations out of the old Yugoslavia. Now, I think what we are seeing in about these last very few years, the question that is being raised is how high the absorption rate of the new immigrants who have not really come voluntarily. They have been forced out of where they were, and of course they have found a good address in terms of wages and social benefits which are conferred upon them from the moment of entry into the country. But there are signs that the system is cracking. I think particularly in Denmark, and I think we all follow this, when the political cartoonist for newspaper, the principal newspaper of the principal peninsula of Denmark, Jyllandsposten, did political cartoons which were caricatures of Mohammed. And you recall the news stories, and the population of the Islamic population of Denmark or some members, they just simply went ballistic, and it was a terrifying period of the Danish embassies in many countries closed, and sent their staffs home because of the threats, the death threats. It put the Danish government and all responsible people in a very difficult quandary. For the Danish and Nordic devotion to the freedom of speech is so profound, and satire is so central in terms of humor and communication, and one could hardly knuckle under. But there were issues of safety here, I said last time when we were talking about the political parties that not coincidentally at that time, when the Danish elections came along, this new movement, which Norway calls the Progress Party, swept, not only captured a lot of seats in the parliament, it captured a majority of seats in the Danish parliament. It may have been a kind of a flip, a short-term phenomenon, because that party got into some trouble and that kind of thing, but it says, you know, there is a fear that is most manifest in Denmark of the five countries. Yes,
you mentioned Progress Party in Norway, but it's also in Denmark.
In
Denmark.
Yes, I rambled into Denmark because of the political cartoon thing here.
Was there a backlash against the immigrants after this, you know, all these threats and everything else like that, where people were like, what are they doing here if they don't want to do part, you know, that sort of thing?
Very, very definitely. There's backlash at every level. Yeah. It's, last year, there were riots in Malmo, the European television was full of pictures and police wearing those big helmets and glass in front of them, etc., quelling the riots. In Norway, I'm trying to be very careful with my words, of course, but there is concern about Pakistani concepts of business and profit making and responsiveness to taxes and that sort of thing, which has created a buzz. I was just back in March and spoke with friends. These are friends out of course, the academic establishment and civil service and so forth, who are the quintessence of tolerance and that sort of thing. But they too, I think, are worried. And I'm not being a very good social scientist here. I'm letting my gut speak. But I have a great worry about Western Europe in reference to all of this, because what I am describing in the Nordic countries is probably much, much more acute in, say, France, Holland, Switzerland. Forgive my ethnocentrism if it is that, but I rather think that we have done much better in the United States with our immigration. Well, we have been accommodating immigrants from the get-go, haven't we? And I think that we have learned, I'm not sure I want to include Arizona here, but I think we have learned the danger of drawing lines in the sand in regard to immigrant policy. And though I swerve now, and I very deliberately don't want this course to be about all of Europe or that sort of thing, but I think, for example, of Switzerland, which a few months ago, recall, passed a law forbidding the construction of minarets. There are, I believe, a sum total of 4 minarets in all of Switzerland. Now, unless I missed the point, I don't know why on earth the Swiss government would have wanted to get that hard-nosed about an issue that I just fail to see the significance of it, but I know that the world is, it's a world of symbols and images and metaphors. Well, with that, before we wave farewell to beautiful immigration in Norden, are there any thoughts, questions, perspectives before I go on? Yes, I'll start here and move there. Yeah.
Do you think that Switzerland? Do you think that Switzerland is like that because they've always tended to sort of be more of an isolationist kind of country?
I suppose. But I don't know.
It's like they're very protective of themselves.
I just don't know enough about Switzerland, but I only mentioned it as one of the things I might have used, the way the French have come down on the burqa. Well, that's a line in the sand, and I don't know how you enforce it. I think it is escalating the problems, and the Nordic countries are not immune from this. Norway, incidentally, just passed something which says, which they do not forbid the wearing of religious garb, the burqa, the ski mask, whatever, but they do specify certain occupations. Teachers may not. Mm-hmm. The child should be able to read the face of the teacher. Police officers may not, or healthcare workers, you need, you know, that kind of thing. They're trying a soft version. But again, I think what we are seeing in Europe to some degree, maybe not so much in the North, but is what I have called drawing lines in the sand. And there was another hand up before we move on. I think it was someone else here before I call on my person twice. All right.
One thought I jumped in real quick about the minarets is minarets are used for calling. And, you know, the callers would go up into the minarets and call mm-hmm. out over the community. And it's very much invasive if you live near one of these minarets and some guy, you know, 3 times mm-hmm. a day was yelling out mm-hmm. over your neighborhood. I think that would be a little intrusive.
Yeah.
But what percentage in the different countries are you mentioned percentages in school age, but what percentages now are the populations as far as the immigrant population? Ten percent?
It's very hard to count because people are in flux. They are going back to where they came from. They have been sending money home to build a house in Croatia for their retirement, etc. They don't have to register when they leave the country, but more to the point, on the success side of the ledger in the labor force immigration in Sweden, so many of these immigrants have been very successfully assimilated. They have married Swedes, etc. So you can see the definitional problems. Surely, and that's why the use of children whose parents speak a different language is a pretty good base. And keep in mind that's probably 30 to 40% in the cities of children have at least one parent whose primary language is non-Nordic. So I've waffled a little bit, but I just don't know how we count. The immigrants now. So back to your question last time, Andy. You could argue that what happened, it wasn't a total success because it drew away. And yet, through the 1970s, a very high percentage of the people who came are now highly assimilated. Their children are graduates of Swedish schools and universities. You open the white pages of the Stockholm Gothenburg telephone directory, which are online, incidentally, and you look for V-I-C-H ending names, and there are just a lot of them. Okay. We'll move on now to, shall we call it Social Work 101. Some of the public policy programs dealing with people who are at risk for in one way or another, and I'd like to start with children, and the great and the very central role among the cabinet officers in the Nordic countries is the person who is the minister for. Call it family and children. In addition to a ministry of the government that focuses upon children, there is, in addition to the, in Norway, there are 13 ministries, 13 members of Prime Minister Stoltenberg's cabinet. In addition, there is at least one ombudsperson who is non-political, who does not come out of the parliament, and that is an ombudsperson for children, who, fortified by United Nations statements on the rights of children in the world, is ready to step in and overrule parliamentary law in the interest of children. And let me give a few examples. When that child is born, the first thing parents would do if they had an ounce of brain would be to register the birth, because every family receives a monthly allowance. For each child under the age of 18, in Sweden, the last figures I could come up with, most recently, the numbers aren't important, but just to give you a picture, the child at birth until 18, the parents or parent, in the case of almost half of the births, are two single parents, though many are cohabitating on a permanent basis. I mean, it's a very stable relationship. But we'll get in American dollar $175 a month. And about $107 for the second child and a diminution for the third child, et cetera. And that, consistent with everything about public policy in the Nordic countries, is not need-based. You don't have to prove eligibility. It is an entitlement. There was a picture in Oslo's paper, Aftenposten, that when the Crown Prince, whose name is Haakon, and the crown, his wife, Crown Princess Mette Marit, had their first child, Alexandra, which assures that Norway will have a queen down the road. They are pictured standing at the, you know, at the city hall or wherever you go, signing up for their childbirth allowance. Yes, Sustina.
I have relatives in Sweden, and my cousin, she's a nurse, and she got paid for a full year.
Yes, I'm going to come. Yes.
You know.
Okay, I want to spell that one out. Yes, you're right. She got. I know what she got.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So there's. The financial assistance, and then Sydney, forgive me for cutting you off there, but the concepts of parental leave, they vary from country to country, but I'll use Denmark. I think it's rather typical, which is that a mother will get. The exact things aren't important here, but something like 10 months to be home with the child will get her full pay. Not from the employer, but from a fund to which employers and the taxpayers generally contribute. But the mother will only get that if the father, who may not be a husband, takes approximately 2 months to be with the child. And they work it out, they duke it out, except that the mother must be with the child in the first 6 weeks of the child's life. In Sweden, the program is really much more generous. And indeed, to segue, the big election in Sweden will be now in September, and the bourgeois coalition seems, according to the polls, to be in trouble. And if Labour gets in, they have already sounded the trumpet that they will insist upon the bio father being with the child for 4 months. What you think?
Wow.
That's yeah. Great.
And you know, pardon me for being polite, but
honestly, how do they pay for all that?
Tax
war.
Yeah,
or there is a tax rate.
They don't have a military.
If I tell you now in round four, what will I say in round five?
I don't know.
Just say me.
Trust me, we'll get to it. But if I may, in the United States, what do we pay out for professional child care for our infants? You gotta subtract or do something here, don't you?
We pay for it later on in their life.
That's
well,
right. Yeah.
That certainly is the philosophy of the ministries child care. And Jan, this is your bailiwick.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I don't have the statistics off the top of my head, but if we put more money into young children and early childhood education, we would be putting much less money into the prison system, which is growing by leaps and bounds in the United States, and we're putting far more money into that. So, you know, you can choose, you can pay now or you can pay later, and they're paying now rather than later.
Well, I suppose most interesting in public policy is the transformation of the roles of men, isn't it? To be home doing daddy care. And incidentally, the father could take all of that chunk that year, give or take, except the first 6 weeks. I mean, for all I, anyway, here's, he probably could be home too, but that's not the centerpiece.
What if the father doesn't care to be involved?
Pardon?
What if the father doesn't care to be involved?
Yeah, I always get that question. I would say that the ombudsperson has staff in every jurisdiction, and the ombudsperson would likely rule on that. And if the father, or for that matter, the mother is incompetent, you know, some kind of slimy, drug-using alcoholic or something like that, an exception would be made. But yes, back there.
What do they then do about custody of children where a parent is demonstratively,
an incompetent parent?
Incompetent parent, yeah.
I think the courts would assign custody. Definitely. Yes, sir.
So when you're talking about the mother taking 10 months and the father taking 2 months, is there some sort of an assumption here that we were dealing with a double income family? And I mean, if mom is staying home with the kids all the time.
We are dealing with a double income family, almost certainly. Almost all women work outside the home.
Okay.
So, yeah. Now, there are, of course, all kinds of consequences. The firm, the law firm, in downtown Aarhus, the second city in Denmark, a woman is their prime intellectual property attorney, and her clients aren't going to wait around for her mummy here to end. It means that the workplace changes. There has to be a lot more, what's the term now, cross-training of people in the workplace so that they can pick up work for one another. It's sort of like a university faculty where in every department, every year, there are a couple of people on unpaid leave, sabbatical leave, blah, 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 that sort of thing. And everyone, I mean, mechanisms informally have to be found whereby people cover. Or, of course, the employer adds a temporary person. But it's complicated, as you can well imagine, if you're managing the firm or the agency. Yes?
How long a period of time has this been going on?
Oh.
Because I think, you know, they have refined it and defined it and so over a longer period of time, but I just wonder what the period is.
I should think for 20, it seems to me as long as I've been putting my nose into this stuff, it's been there, but it's morphing always. The system is tinkered with. But I don't think, again, if you go back to the political parties that we talked about last time, I don't think this is an issue in which the bourgeois coalition is going to wave a red flag and want this eliminated. This is expensive, but it's the same everywhere in the world, isn't it? People may grumble about the costs, but ask them if they want to eliminate the services, and you get a different tune. So. More about children. because parents work, families are overwhelmingly dual income, there is a huge infrastructure of early childhood, pre-kindergarten places. And there's been an interesting morphing in that regard too. When we came to live in Oslo with three small children, the opportunity for our daughter, she became a part of an open air kindergarten with a park conta, and those kids were just sort of outside. There was no building. There was no shelter, and diapers filled, and outdoors. And I remember once commenting to Norwegians that the children have such wonderful rosy cheeks. And the Norwegians said, "Don't you know why? All their blood vessels have burst." But it has become a professionalized industry now with people who go to early childhood educator schools and that kind of thing. But therein lies a key to the need for child support payments. Though these schools may be subsidized, we know all about that in the United States. And somebody had a hand up.
Yeah, well, it was just to ask if it was a free system.
Yeah, there are government early childhood centers and there are private, but many people will opt private because the waiting lists are so great or to do with the convenience, the locations and hours and so forth.
Question.
So a child goes, from a very early age, after the mommy and daddy year is over, Peter?
Just real quick, you know, you mentioned that these programs have been in existence for over 20 years.
Oh,
have they seen, you know, the types of benefits that was mentioned about the prisons and other things? Have they really, the social experiment of all this additional attention with the children, have they seen benefits come out of this, or has any of it been documented, or as far as the behavior of the young people, how well they perform in school, how successful they become as they get out of school, that sort of thing?
Well, it isn't exactly database medicine here I'm offering, but because you don't know if some developments are because of or in spite of, we don't have a control group and an experimental group of children who have and haven't had this experience. All children have had it. But let me just say, and maybe I'm getting ahead of my story here, but very low incidence of teenage pregnancy. Very high incidence of completion of secondary school. These are outcomes, but whether because of or in spite of, who knows? If you deal with research models, as we all should, I don't think the question is answerable in a simple way. When the childhood period ends and elementary school begins, so that is germane to tomorrow's topic, but I think it will wrap in better here today. Again, a morphing. Historically, the Nordic countries began schooling with first grade. They don't have kindergartens because they've had all this early childhood. First grade at age 7. And when we came and said we had a 6-year-old who was ready to go into first grade, they were horrified. And these what I call the ed psych establishment would scream, but their eyes aren't ready yet. For reading, etc., they were much more cautious. But as a side note, it became simply impossible to maintain 7 as the year of starting school with mothers working and that sort of thing, and all the complications of daycare. The political pressures were so great that now children there generally speaking, I can't speak for every country and at every moment, but start, as do our children, in first grade at age six. But the philosophy of the elementary schools is, I think, quite different in this regard. And again, take out your calculators and start figuring costs as I speak. But there is a strong belief that the most important obligation of a society to provide for its children is a stable peer group. And so the child who is assigned to Fru Gundersen for first grade, those children will stay together insofar as it can be engineered all the way through sixth grade. I'm passionately of the belief that is a way of restructuring a society, and this is a course called Are Any of the Public Policy Experiments in the Nordic Countries Applicable Elsewhere? And that cohort of children will keep the same teacher. There are different variations on it. There's I guess now it's thought by the people who are researching this that maybe the same teacher for first, second, and third grade, and then a new teacher for fourth, fifth, and sixth. But there is very little turnover, and probably much less proclivity for a family to sell and move elsewhere, because it becomes a system in which it is believed that this is a good thing for children. Yes.
I'm a member of an organization called OMEP, which is the French acronym for the World Organization of Early Childhood Education, and they always uphold the Scandinavian countries as having the most child-focused and nurturing education environment for young children for long-term benefits, short and long-term benefits. I mean, in the United States, we always look, well, what is that going to do down the road? What is it going to, how is it going to benefit us? How is it going to benefit the child, the child later on in the gross national product? Well, they don't look at that in Scandinavia. They look at what it's benefiting the child right now at age one. So then that child will progress and be more appropriate for age two. And on down the road, rather than saying, like we do, how is it going to benefit us way down the road?
Yeah.
So.
They continue with their peer group, this group, all the way through their 30s and the 40s. Because I know these same children from when they were little. It's the same whole core. There's more. And it's more diverse.
It is impressionistic on my part, but I've had a career dealing with college students, and I think of those times when people have really talked about their lives and their childhoods, etc. And I have been struck by the number of these very bright students in these very good colleges who say, "I have never had friends. I've never had the experience." It's sort of like the old country school in rural America, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Our country, we are so much more transitory. I mean, I had a class at Bible school last week, and we were talking about Abraham. And I said, how many of you, I was talking about third graders, how many of you have ever moved? Any of you moved more than once? The hands would go up. Our kids are so, have so many, I'm not going to say opportunities, but they do move. Our families move around a lot.
That's right. And if the labor force demands in the Nordic countries were such, of course, many more families there would have to move. The company is closing the plant in Aarhus and moving to Odense or something like that. But there hasn't been so much of that, and there's much more inclination in the Nordic countries that it is the breadwinners, plural, who will travel, but that the children, but that they keep their residence where it was so that the children have the space. But what I'm trying to say is children, 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 in terms of focus, the oldest person and all of that.
Maybe it has something to do with it's all stability.
The cost.
The children, stability with these families and the
The cost item here, it's really administrative to see that, to match Fru Gunderson and that cohort, because it can be like quicksilver for them. I have told friends in the Nordic countries that of a pattern that I have seen developing in some of the more affluent suburbs in the metro from which I come, in which parents, it's very important to parents that they have a role in selecting their child's teachers, and that mothers, forgive the gender reference, are known to come visiting, the mother of the third grader to visit each fourth grade teacher's classroom, and then to start putting pressure on or whatever it was with the principal as to what teacher they want. I must say that would not get a sympathetic hearing in the Nordic countries. You got Fru Gunderson. obviously there's some major problem. That's why the principal, of course, could intervene. And it very much changes the role of the teacher. She or he becomes much more of a repository of a great deal of knowledge, of a thick file about each child. Faith.
Then are the teachers still far more respected than we give them in this country today, and are they really better prepared to be the teacher, or why such trust? Because I just sat back here saying to my husband, I was that parent to say in Anthony Park, I said, which teacher I wanted to teach a child, because I knew the teachers and I'd been a teacher. Mm-hmm. So is there a greater trust? Are they more professionally prepared?
Elementary school teachers are not prepared in the university system. Secondary teachers are. They have two examinations, these two subjects to teach secondary. Elementary teachers are prepared in very much like the old normal school in the United States. I think that the pedagogy is very thorough. I think it's about a 3-year program, but that doesn't quite get at the question of trust. I would say I'm trying to think if I can document this, but teachers are more apt to live locally, to be a part of their communities or neighborhoods, and to be regarded as educated people and respected. My answer is a little fuzzy, but I would say yes. But more than that, come back to a point. Giving individuals the right to select, which is so cherished in certain societies we can name, is not, I think, the predominant value. The predominant value here is that the child have a very stable environment. Even if Fru Gunderson is an old bag,
Well, like you said, if the group of children is the critical thing, then obviously, if all the parents of all the 20 kids had different decisions on who they thought that group of kids should have, I mean, it would be almost like a vote or something,
Yeah.
So it's more important to keep kids together, right?
Yep. That's right. Yes, Rob.
I think a related thing that we have to mention is the measurement of happiness in the different countries.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know off the top of my head, except that America's are way down on the scale as far as the population happiness, whereas the Nordic countries are way up there, even with their high taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of research evidence. I mean, there are a lot of empirical studies of satisfaction, happiness, trust, etc., which would back you. What you're saying, Rob? Well, these are just a few of the elements concerning children, and your syllabus says we're going to get through medical care and old age. I think we'll bag old age because there are no old people. We are young and vital, and what do we care about the elderly? But I want to intrude with just a couple notes as trying to envision a life cycle in which people go from being children. I'll come back to their university studies tomorrow, but to get into just a couple of workplace issues as they enter the workplace. First, what should the balance be in a workplace between committed time to the employer and private time? As roughly, I would say this, in the Nordic countries, from the day you enter the labor force, and perhaps at a very entry level or first year kind of job, you will have 4 weeks of paid vacation. So when we ask how the Nordics can travel so much as just the Mediterranean and that sort of thing, well, they have more time with which to do it.
That's why
that number goes up. Now, again, to speak for the National Federation of Employers, for the Conservative Party, has the role of saying then we must become more efficient in the use of time if we are going to compete in the world market, especially with Japan and the United States. Don't hold me to the numbers, but this, I think I saw this, that the average worker in Japan puts in about 2,300 hours a year. Well, if you took 50 weeks multiplied by 40, you get 2,000, so you see. And the United States is somewhere in the 2,100, 2,200. And the Nordic countries are somewhere around 1,600. Because the day is a little shorter, not much, but a little bit shorter probably. And in addition to the 4 weeks of paid holiday, these thoroughgoing secular societies, in which 97% of the population haven't darkened the door of a church since the day they were dipped, baptized. The old Roman Catholic calendar, the first and second days of Pentecost, Ascension Day, Whitsun, etc., threw in about, how many of the holy days, and add the holidays. In the month of May, you just never really come out of holiday. Between that old Labor Party rituals that surround May the 1st, Labor Day, through Constitution Day in Norway and that sort of thing. So workplace needs to be much more, it needs to be very competitive if Nokia is to compete with Motorola, for example. And let me make just a note on compensation as we break. I think perhaps the easiest way to say it is that in the studies I've seen, and this is very difficult research, but would indicate that the CEO is carrying home after taxes about 4 to 5 times what the average entry-level first-tier worker is carrying home. It's a factor of 4.5. I leave it to you to connect some dots here. There was there's a very interesting interview in the Wall Street Journal not long ago with the CEO of Lego, the Great Danish, one of Europe's leading on the big board firms. And this was the Wall Street Journal, keep in mind. He says, I carry home about $170,000 a year after taxes. And so the reporter says, well, in the U.S., your counterpart would carry home, fill in the dots here, and the blanks. And the very young CEO of Lego says, you know, my family and I can't find the time in our lives to spend the 170. And with that, thanks for being a part of round 4.